I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, the founder of Women for Women International, an organization that assists female survivors of war in countries including Rwanda, Kosovo, Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Women for Women has provided over $100 million in direct aid and microfinance loans, and the organization also helps women start their own small businesses. Zainab grew up in Iraq, where her family had ties to Saddam Hussein. Her father was his personal pilot. She is the author of Between Two Worlds, a memoir that describes her life growing up under Saddam's Ba'athist regime, and The Other Side of War, Women's Stories of Survival and Hope. Welcome.
Thank you.
When you were growing up in Iraq, what did you dream to be?
Oh, well, like as any child and teenager, I went through a whole series of dreams from wanting to be a pilot to wanting to be an architect. But really, at the age of 15, I knew that I wanted to work with women and help women. I remember that moment very, very clearly. It was after my mom made me read so many books about women's issues and told me so many stories of what goes on with women. And I remember she was driving one afternoon in Iraq, one evening actually in Iraq, and I told her, when I grow up, I'm going to help women. I'm going to dedicate my life to helping women. And I remember her turning towards me, looking at me, and she says, and you can do it. Mm-hmm. And I never forgot that moment. And that has been my journey ever since. I went on a detour here and there, but really the journey started in a very early age of 23 when I started Women for Women International.
Why did your mom encourage you to read books about women?
Well, my mom, I think she wanted to pass on what happens to women. My grandmother, for example, married at the age of 13 to a man older than her. She was an orphan. And even though my grandfather was a nice guy, he was older than her. And she went through a lot of suffering in terms of being under the control of another household, basically. My grandmother made sure that all of her children, particularly her girls, went to school and finished universities. And that's the story of my mother. There was a change throughout a generation. My mom was a working woman, a college graduate. She was a biology teacher. But then she still struggled between the expectations of a modern woman, you know, working independent, and that she was a wife and a mother. And the expectations of her as a wife and a mother never changed, actually, and never adapted. The other reason is that we were living in war, and particularly with my family, we were very much close to Saddam Hussein's environment. And that meant we were closer to danger. It did not mean that we were actually protected from danger. And so for a diversity of reasons and all of these reasons, my mom was very passionate that I had to be strong, that I had to be independent. As a teenager, she would hold me and shake me with passion. She says, you must be independent. You must be strong. Never cry. Never let anybody touch you or talk with you in the wrong way. And she's like, she even told me I should never learn how to cook or clean because no man should expect me to do that just because I was a woman.
Is your mom still alive?
My mom died, actually, at the age of 52. And in the process of her death, she gave me another beautiful journey and gifts, actually. She had Lou Gehrig's disease, and I took care of her the last year of her life. In that last year, she told me my story. Because, you see, I came to America when I was 20 years old through an arranged marriage. And I was very upset that this strong woman, my mother, who told me I have to be independent and I have to fall in love and all of these things, or I should choose my husband, all of a sudden begs me for an arranged marriage with a guy I barely knew and older than me, much older than me.
Why did she do that? Did you ever learn to understand why she did arrange the marriage ultimately?
Ultimately, 9 years later, so I was very mad at her, to be honest. But she cried, and she was like, you have to listen. You just have to do it. At the end of the day, honestly, I was a daughter who did not want to see her mother cry. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. But when she finally came for medical treatment and we knew she was dying, that's when I asked her, "Why? What happened? Why did you do that to me?" It was only then that she wrote to me because she could not speak at that time. She lost her voice. That she did that because she was so worried that Saddam Hussein, who, again, we were hanging out with him in the weekends and many weekdays as well, started to make comments about me as adult woman, as an adult woman. And she just felt it, and she said, you know, she became the lioness mother. You know, I needed to get my daughter out. Mm-hmm. It was interesting because I remember these moments, and I just saw him as my father's friend and uncle, sort of, you know. So I didn't pay attention to these moments. As an adult woman today, I do see what she saw, and I understand. And I, in retrospect, I think she is no different than mothers that, you know, the images of Vietnamese mother throwing their babies at American soldiers saying, take them. And eventually in my life, I meet a lot of women who offer me their daughters, like, take her, maybe you'll give her a better life. My mom was doing exactly the same.
And was the man an American, or?
He was Iraqi-American, and he was actually everything my mama told me not to tolerate. There was a lot of verbal abuse, physical abuse, dependence on him financially. And it's so interesting because it became a very intensive experience of a bad marriage over 3 months.
And good for you that you got out after 3 months. Other people might stick around, especially wanting to please their mothers.
Well, in these 3 months, Iraq had invaded Kuwait, and I was cut off from my family. I could not even reach them by phone, and I really had to make the decision on my own.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, founder of Women for Women International, an organization that provides aid to women in war zones. So you left Iraq in 1990 when you were roughly 21 years old. What did you do professionally, or what did you pursue?
Well, up until then, I have never worked in my life in Iraq. If you come from a, you know, comfortable, financially comfortable family, it's not, you don't work at all, and it's like socially outrageous. So I find myself, I left my ex-husband. I had $400 in my pocket. My first job was actually at Hallmark as a clerk, you know, and I remember being so excited to work. And then eventually I went to the Limited. I did all the things that, you know, I guess teenagers in here do it. I did it as a 21-year-old.
The Limited, the clothing company.
The clothing company. And then eventually I worked in a medical lab. And, you know, but really for 2 years, I'm really working here and there, just earning a living, you know, a translator, an assistant, all of that. It took me, so that's really between the age of 20, 21 to 23. And that's when I decided to start Women for Women. But the point is I had not much work experience at the time.
Right. But when you got your first job at Hallmark and you mentioned that you were elated because you were working for the first time, was that your state in general, one of kind of zen and happiness having gone through this turmoil? Or what was your psychological state at the time?
Yeah. That time was a very hard time. That time, not only did I left an abusive marriage. And, you know, when I mean an abusive marriage, beside the verbal abuse and the dependent, but, you know, I was also raped in that marriage. It was really a bad arrangement. And not only did I not have any money, mm-hmm. I was cut off from my family. So it all happened at the same time for me. So I remember being glued to the TV stations at that time, or TV rather, and just seeing the Gulf War. It was the first time we have a coverage, I think, of a war with all the blue screens, if you remember. And I had no idea if my family were alive or dead. I managed to finally call my mom, or she called me rather the day before the war, and she gave me her will. And she said, I don't know if we're going to see you. You need to know we have this and this and this and this in the family in case we never see you again. So it was a very hard time in my life, actually. It was, I felt abandoned and alone and cut off from my family.
And how much did your own personal experience of conflict and chaos echo the war that the women you support experience?
They all in one picture. There is no separation, I think. I understand what it means to live in war. Mm-hmm. Now, I lived in a privileged life, nevertheless, so don't take me wrong in here, but the sound of bombs, the fear, the fear of death, you know, and I felt that as a teenager, as a child, actually.
And then even in the United States, the fear of being harmed in your own personal life.
Right.
You seem to speak so freely about what happened. Have you always been able to speak freely about it?
I was embarrassed for the longest time about it.
And then what was the turning point to say, okay, I'm going to open this valve?
One of the very women that I thought I was helping, end up helping me. And this has been really the journey. Mm-hmm. I wanted to write a book on Iraqi women right after Iraq. And I remember my publisher saying, or my agent calling rather, and saying, you really need to write it about yourself, without knowing my story. And I cried. I was like, no, it's not about me. It's da-da-da. It's about other women. It's not about me, you know. But that day I was in Congo. And while in Congo, I honestly was, I interviewed right after that call a woman called Nabitu. And Nabitu was a 52-year-old woman, homeless, completely poor. She was telling me about how she was raped, gang raped. Her sons were forced to spread their mother's hands and legs open. Her 9-year-old, 21-year-old, 22-year-old daughters were raped, also gang raped in front of her. How the rebels not only raped them, but pillaged everything and they burnt everything. And she said, I never told this story to anybody but you. So I looked at her and said, so I am someone who talks about stories. Would you like me to keep this one secret? And she looks at me and I never forgot that moment. She says, if I can tell the whole world about my story, I would. So other women would not have to go through what I've gone through. But I can't. You can. You go ahead and tell the story, just not to the neighbors. And I had to drive five hours from Congo to Rwanda that day. And I promise you, I cried throughout these whole 5 hours because I realized in that moment that this woman, humble, illiterate, poor, homeless, you know, lost everything in her life, has far more courage than I had. And it was a breaking point in my life. It was like, I can't actually claim to serve the women if I don't act what I'm asking them to do. And that was the breaking moment.
It's interesting. Some people might have had an opposite reaction, which is, whoa, I see myself too much in these people that I'm trying to help. I want to run away from it.
I feel because I lived in fear, in dictatorships and close to a dictatorship. I mean, I lived in times in which my family was socialized with Saddam and he would talk about how he killed his best friend the night before. And I would see my parents pale and scared to death. Mm-hmm. So that fear was so much in my DNA. So I really had a choice. Generally, any concept of fear or any trigger of fear, either face it and look at it in the eyes and take a chance that I can actually overcome it or continue to be imprisoned by it. Mm-hmm. Now, in the process of writing my memoir, by confronting my fear, by showing my nakedness almost, you know, I actually protect myself. It was my freedom. I always joke and says I went through therapy and got paid for it.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, founder of Women for Women International. We'll hear more from Zainab coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, the founder of Women for Women International, an organization that assists female survivors of war in countries including Rwanda, Kosovo, Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Zainab started Women for Women in 1993 with her then husband Amjad Atala after she learned about the war in Bosnia. So you decide to start Women for Women International. How did you wake up one day and say, this is what I want to do?
So when I finally moved to Washington, D.C., I fell in love with a wonderful man, and we got married, Amjad Atala.
A Palestinian-American.
And I went back to school. So I went back to school at George Mason University, and I remember a class that I took that for the first time, I learned about the Holocaust. You know, they didn't teach us that back home. But that same month happened to have on the front page of Times Magazine an image, a picture of a guy behind barbed wires, very, very thin, starved guy, who very much looked very similar images to the one of the Holocaust. So I happened to be one of those people who learned about the two facts in the same month. But people said never again, but it's happening similarly things again, so we have to do something. Anyway, long story short, I was actually at Denny's midnight and talking about how we can help.
And At Denny's,
right.
The restaurant,
yes. So I was at Denny's with my former husband, Amjad, and my brother-in-law, and I was like, well, how about if we sponsor women? How about if we just send them letters, manage to exchange letters between women, show them that the world is still a good place, but then give them cash? You know, you see humanitarian aid give food or secondhand clothes or whatever, no one thinks about giving cash. And with that has a dignity and the integrity to go to the store and buy whatever it is you want. So it was June 1993. September 1993, I went to Croatia with sponsorship funds for 33 women. This is basically the program then and the program now. We ask every woman to send $30 a month to one woman survivor of war and exchange pictures and letters with her if she wishes and as she wishes for an entire year. But in September 1993, I took cash with me and names from American women from all different places. And I was like, this is how we're going to launch it, and started with 33 women. Now, this became 300,000 women.
How did you get the financing?
My former husband and I used some of the savings that we had for our honeymoon because we were newlyweds and we postponed our honeymoon. And then we raised money from, you know, different crowds, really, from Amnesty International Group, Unitarian Church Group. And that's how we started it.
Now, Amjad, you are no longer married. But how much of a role did he play in the early days with you?
He was the backbone of it. He was the one who wrote the incorporation papers. He was the one who got all the logistics aspect of it. He also was the one who worked and earned a living, you know, as I run it full time.
What was he doing working?
Gosh, I felt, you know, Amjad was actually on a PhD track at the University of Virginia, and he decided to drop out and to work really, oh, poor thing. He just... you know, was a temp and was a whatever, different things just so we can earn a living, just so we can do that. So for 3 years, I wasn't earning any living and just doing this. And we were sending 100% of every penny we raised. So we were on the brink of like saying, well, we don't know if we can do it. You know, we were poor kids to start with, and we were giving 100% of everything we had, and we were really having a hard time survive.
So what was the turning point?
The turning point was I got a check for $67,000, something like that, from Working Assets. So someone had heard me on a radio interview, nominated me to Working Assets. It's a company that donates 1% of its revenue or $1 million of its revenue a year. It's a phone company and a credit card company. Mm-hmm. I honestly did not know about that. But the check came for $67,500, I remember. And I remember looking up the sky and said, okay, I think I'm meant to stay. And that's when I stayed and hired a couple of staff, and it took us the second wind, basically.
This might be too personal for you to answer, but to what extent did the difficulties of getting Women for Women off the ground, to what extent did that cause your marriage to deteriorate?
Not at all. If anything, it was actually one of the best years of that whole period. Was a wonderful years of our marriage. Now, we went through a very hard time financially, but I remember we had no question about our commitment to what we were doing. Yeah. And just no question about commitment to each other. The marriage actually went deteriorated in far more latter years when everything was growing and it was okay and, you know, and pursuing different dreams. But that, on the opposite, if anything, it strengthened our marriage, not hurt it at all.
So you received this check for $68,000. Who was the individual who sent it to you?
I never knew. But until today, I never knew who this was. She was a listener, I think, to a radio. I honestly don't know.
By the way, you mentioned, you don't know the woman who recommended you. It could have been a man, right?
Oh, it could be a man. Yes, yeah, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, really and honestly, men have been wonderful supporters throughout from President Clinton to Mayor Bloomberg, actually, who have been really wonderful supporters to our initiative.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, founder of Women for Women International, an organization that assists women who have survived wars in countries including Bosnia, Rwanda, Iraq, and Afghanistan. She's one of 20 leaders chosen by President Clinton to work on the Clinton Global Initiative LEAD program. How do you help people logistically?
Well, the development of the whole template of the project came throughout the years. You sponsor a woman for one year only. In that 1 year, she is grouped with 25 other women. And with the 25 women, she goes through two kinds of training. One, an educational program that teaches her really about her rights, her own the value of her, of being her, a woman, and the value of her own contributions, and teach her about the services that are accessible to her. So it is teaching her from her legal rights to her political rights, go vote, to nutritional health issues, to her economic values and the different things that she can do for budget management and things like that. So what we call that an educational program that goes along with very basic literacy and numeracy. Now, we also have parallel to that vocational and business skills training. And we teach women skills that has market demands. And that goes from, honestly, from food to service industries to manufacturing, meaning different things, embroideries and things like that, but much more to sell hats and gloves and whatever it is. We have partnerships with companies like Kate Spade, but also women have their own market locally, to carpentry and shoe production and all of these things. So really we do market assessment and we teach them very, very practical skills. At the end of the year, they graduate, big ceremony. It's beautiful. They get their official certificates. And almost all the women, this is the first time, they get a certificate. And usually they frame it and put it in their living room. And then that's after that, we help them to place them in jobs, basically, and in income-generating opportunities.
Could you provide an example of how you've helped a woman?
A woman that I recently met in Afghanistan, and her name is Yakuba. And Yakuba was promised to be married at the age of 6, sent to her in-laws at the age of 6. The boy she was to marry was 9 years old. Now, they don't marry immediately. When they get married, when she was 15. And he gets killed when she was 16 and a pregnant woman. So at 16, she is a widow and a single mother living in an abusive household with his in-laws, with her in-laws. Poverty strikes, and she ends up going and selling hats in the streets of Afghanistan during the Taliban time. And she talks about how the Taliban one time saw her with a slipper, an open slipper, so her toes were showing, and they came and whipped her. But she also talked about how she grabbed that whip, the hand, and grabbed the whip and threw it. And when I asked her what occurred to you, what triggered you to do that, and she said it wasn't the pain of the beating, it was the humiliation of being beaten was more painful. Then the Taliban leave and she joins our program with nothing really. She learns embroidery, but she had really particular skills, you know, and so we end up hiring her as a teacher. And she took a loan on the side to start a business. 5 years later, she has $30,000 in her bank account.
We were talking before about a pivot point for you and for the organization when you received your first big check. But certainly now the organization has provided over $100 million in direct aid and microfinance credit. Were there specific allies financially or on the PR front that helped escalate the organization to a whole other level?
Well, there are a couple of pivot points in the organization, few. One was the working assets check. The second was a journalist from AP who did an article about two women, one from Michigan and one from Bosnia, and they were exchanging letters. And that got covered front pages in about 13 newspapers in America. That helped really trigger a whole new wave of media attention, and media has always been really the most important source for people to know about us and to support us. Then Oprah Winfrey Show. Oprah came to us in September 2000, as a matter of fact. I had no idea who Oprah was before. They identified us. They identified me particularly. They wanted to do a small segment. It was called Remember Your Spirit segment. And I remember going home and watching Oprah. I was like, wow, this is an amazing woman. 10 shows later, Oprah was actually a major turning point in the organization. She featured us 10 times, including the very last show as she was ending her show in 2011. And every time, almost every time she featured us on the show, we get tens of thousands of women joining us.
Conrad Hilton being the hotel entrepreneur. To what extent was your mother's voice in your mind while you were launching Women for Women, even day to day?
She caught me once being in Sarajevo during the war. She was in Baghdad. And Amjad told her, my former husband. And I remember getting a call in Sarajevo from my mom. She was livid. And she was like, I risked my life to get you out of Iraq, only for you to go to another war? Are you crazy? I mean, I remember like just trying to calm her down and feeling I was caught, you know, because I didn't tell her. I didn't tell my family for two reasons. A, we only had 2 minutes of phone calls allowed during Saddam's time in the 90s. So I really had very limited conversations with my family. And B, Saddam was supporting Milosevic in Serbia. So I was afraid of telling them what I did, lest that would put them in danger. So actually, they didn't know the details until she came and visited me the year before her death.
The details of Women for Women.
Of Women for Women International. And I actually remember a couple of weeks only before her death, the Kosovo war started. And I was watching the refugees on TV and the crisis there. And I made a decision that this is my mother. And I'm not going to go. Usually I would go. I would be the first to jump on a plane and say, let's go and see how we can set up. But I was like, I'm taking care of my mother and she's dying and I need to stay with her. And I remember her telling me, go. And I said, no, I have to stay with you. And she says, go. I will wait for you. And sure enough, I went, set up the program over there. And a week later, she died.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, founder of Women for Women International, an organization that provides aid to women in war zones. How is it switching from going from New York City, where you live in Tribeca, to Bosnia or Congo? It must be like a mental seesaw. Or are you able to, you know, step back and be more zen about that transition?
I went through all kinds of stages. You know, I went from the stage of really being very depressed the first few years. I would feel guilty about buying a dress or even seeing water. Then to the stage of anger. I was like, "Bah, people have so much in here. And if you only know, you can save a whole family for the $300 shirt you have." Then to a stage in which I actually, you know what? The world is everything. The world is dark and light. The world is rich and poor. The world is beauty and ugliness. It's just, you know, so I have no judgment anymore about it. I just live it and appreciate both sides and hope and just really, so I no judgment actually. On the opposite, I actually always urge people to go and enjoy their life. Just share a little. Just share some with those who don't have.
Where do you feel most at home?
Honestly, wow. You know, I call myself the people of the people of the bridge, those who do live between two worlds. Every country triggers something in me, and there's the food or the smell or whatever that I feel like the home feeling. And I can't deny when I go to Iraq, I'm amazed that country has a ability to grab my heart and just capture it. And there's so much about it that I don't like. It's so hot. It's the environmentally, like the smell of gasoline is really bad. But I just, it triggers, it's really have a strong hold on my heart and I love it. And I think home is where my bed is and home is when I meditate and that's sort of what anchors me.
You meditate. So for instance, today, have you meditated yet?
Not yet, but I was conscious that I wasn't meditating.
So how about yesterday?
Yesterday I have, indeed.
And how about exercise?
I exercise. I feel very strongly about exercise, actually. And again, this all came really in a learning process because I went through the massacre stage, you know, of, oh my God, you know, I have so much more than these women, to now, I honestly believe one needs to enjoy their life. This is about joy and happiness. I love to exercise. I love to dance. I love clothes. I like looking nice. This is not about, there is this whole myth, at least when I was young, you know, in the 20s, that if you are to work on social activism, that you're supposed to be miserable or not nice looking or whatever it is. And I actually have the opposite.
By the way, you know, you meditate, you exercise, and this, I don't want to sound too simplistic here, but I have thought it would be so helpful for women and men in these regions to be able to get on an exercise bike for a half hour and let off that steam and clear their mind. It's underestimated how important that is.
I understand it, but it takes such strong will to sort of get out of it, and a courageous will to get out of that imprisonment, mental imprisonment, and because the physical environment is not friendly either, you know. So is it possible, for example, for a prisoner to exercise in his or her small cell? Yes, there are many amazing stories of people, you know, walking steps in their, you know, in their solitary confinement or doing yoga or whatever. Is it possible? Yes. Does it take an amazing mental will to say, this is how I'm going to defeat it? Yes. Does it happen? People resist in different ways. And this is the story that I learned, the lessons I learned. Resistance and heroism is not in the big grandiose ways. People resist in small ways. Honestly, when I go to Congo and these women are dancing fiercely, and they were just telling me the stories about their gang raped and their breasts who got cut out in the process of raping. I mean, like torture and all of that. And then a few seconds later, they dance, and that's their resistance. Or running, because we do have Run for Congo Women, and Congolese women run in defiance, basically. You know, a woman whose rebels cut off her legs and she put her artificial leg and run with it just in defiance. So people resist. Bosnian women during the war, I asked them, what do you want me to bring next time I come? They said lipstick. Their resistance was in looking beautiful. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, what Women for Women International do is providing that space for women in these women's centers. We have, I call them safe haven for women, where they can maybe not exercise, but move, because we, you know, part of the classes is to have them move or dance or celebrate themselves. And sometimes it's as simple as needing the space to reaffirm and to re-inspire.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
My guest has been Zainab Salbi, founder of Women for Women International. Coming up, we'll meet Travis Kalanick, co-founder of Uber, an on-demand app that allows you to order a car service using your mobile device. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Travis Kalanick, the co-founder of Uber, an app-powered car service that helps connect drivers and passengers. The service is available in New York City, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Paris, among other cities. Travis started the company in 2010 with co-founder Garris Camp. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So how does Uber work?
You get your iPhone or your Android device out, your smartphone. You push a button, and in 5 minutes, a town car arrives. You can see the car coming to you on the phone. And because you have a credit card on file with us, it truly is like your private driver, because when you get to your destination, you just walk out of the car. Mm. There's no vouchers. There's no tips already included. It's quite an elegant experience.
How did you come up with the idea?
Well, look, in San Francisco, it's very hard to get a cab. The original idea came from my co-founder. Was, I just want to push a button and get a car. And he's like, Travis, we should buy 10 Mercedes S-Classes, get 20 drivers, and lease a parking garage. And I said, Garrett, that is the dumbest idea I've ever heard. Now, the pushing the button and getting a car is actually pretty cool. But to be able to do that with just technology without going into owning cars and all that infrastructure was really a more efficient way of doing it.
So you had this idea. How serious was that partnership initially?
When we first got going with the business, it was really very much a lifestyle type thing. And basically the idea was really this would be for maybe 50 of our friends or 100 of our friends. It used to be you had to get a code from me to become, to be able to use the service. And, you know, my email box started overflowing with people who wanted the special code. So we just opened it up.
Now, the service has been somewhat controversial for a number of reasons, one of which is that you exist outside the medallion system. You have, for instance, New York City taxis. The drivers work very hard to buy a medallion, which is very valuable. And here you are competing with taxis.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, right, is that what a medallion is it's a license to own and operate a cab. In the city of New York, the number of licenses to own and operate cabs has pretty much been the same since the 1940s. That makes those licenses to own and operate a taxi very valuable. In fact, now they're going for about $1 million a piece. It's very rare to have a driver that actually owns a medallion. These are not millionaires driving cars. What it is that you have investors that own the licenses typically, and they run rental car companies, which we call taxi companies, that rent the car out to taxi drivers at the, you know, a cost. It can be like, you know, as an example, like $200 a shift.
The San Francisco Metro Transit Authority issued a cease and desist order.
That's correct.
What was their issue?
There are a number of concerns they had, but I guess in California, the way it works is that the cities regulate taxis and the state regulates limousines, right? The Public Utilities Commission, the guys who regulate your water and your power, also regulate your limousines. So a cease and desist from the city doesn't have a lot of weight when it comes to a company that, which is Uber, working with a bunch of permitted, licensed limo companies, which are regulated by the state. But the name of our company was Uber Cab, and they said, well, you're marketing yourselves as a taxi company. They have jurisdiction over taxi. And so we took the cab off.
Another part of the controversy surrounding Uber is this dynamic pricing, where as the demand for cars increases, so does the price.
Yeah.
And dynamic pricing exists with hotels and airlines. How did you decide to institute dynamic pricing initially?
Right. Dynamic pricing is what we institute when there's an extreme imbalance between supply and demand. And so everybody knows, let's say in New York, around shift change, like 4 to 5 p.m. or so, all the taxis then do it, you know, then go in and they switch out drivers. So right at the time when everybody needs a taxi is the time when there are no taxis around. And if we don't raise the price, our partners, which are limo companies, will go elsewhere because there is a surge situation. They can make money elsewhere.
Uber has a rating service where the customer rates the driver and vice versa.
Yeah.
What dynamic does that create?
What's interesting about Uber is that we are completely accountable and transparent. So you get a receipt when you're done taking a ride that shows the exact route that was taken, the speed, the distance. And in addition, when you're done with the ride, you rate the driver and the driver rates you. Because of that accountability, all actors in the system act much better. Drivers love it because the riders are acting, you know, civilized, and vice versa.
You have raised capital from a number of venture capitalists, one of which is Benchmark in San Francisco. Can you tell me about that initial encounter?
I had a partners meeting there right after I had a partners meeting with Sequoia. I had an Uber take me to Sand Hill Road and drop me off at Sequoia. And I was just going to hit the button to get the Uber back and take it a mile and a half down the road to Benchmark. I finished my Sequoia meeting, opened up my app, and my Uber wasn't there. I'm stressing out a little bit because I can't go and call Benchmark that I'm going to be late because my system that I'm pitching them isn't working. What I did was I started running. I had my dress shoes on. I had my bag with my laptop, and I started running down Sand Hill Road. And I ran a mile and a half down to Benchmark from Sequoia. Was about 15 minutes late, was sweating, and I'm like, what's going on? They had called my Uber while I was at Sequoia and took it off the system. It was a prank. Anyways, the meeting went really well. This is pretty rare. They put me in a separate room after the partners meeting. They met, you know, they were talked about it for about 15 minutes, and they came in the room and they wanted to do a deal right on the spot. Now, I wasn't really going to let that happen, but the next day I get to my office and there's a box on my desk, and that box was a shoe box, and those guys had bought me running shoes. And so every once in a while I might tweet out or something like that, like I've got my Benchmark shoes on today.
And did they know that you were coming from Sequoia?
They probably did because the car was right outside of Sequoia, so they could open up their app and see the car there.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Travis Kalanick, the co-founder of Uber, an on-demand car service that helps you find a car using your smartphone. You grew up in Los Angeles, and your background is in computer engineering. You went to UCLA. You didn't graduate from there.
That's correct. Before
starting college, you formed an SAT tutoring company. What were your SAT scores?
Let's just say they're really high. I think I was like 1580.
So did you start this company? What happened was
I started tutoring SATs in my summer between high school and college. And so it wasn't really a company at that point. But the first person I tutored went up by about 400 points. That's like going from community school to like a UC school, right? That's like a big deal. And pretty soon I was tutoring all the kids on the block, right? At some point, one of the fathers of one of the kids I was tutoring said, let's start a company.
How did you go about getting the clients?
The kid that I was tutoring was Korean background, right? And his family generally they went to a Korean church. And so the father, which basically was my business partner, would recruit all of the kids from the Korean church. And so I was the only white guy in the school. And I learned a lot about Korean culture, but it was just kind of an interesting story.
So you were a senior at UCLA when you started your second company called Scour, which was a peer-to-peer search engine technology. Yeah. And that was similar to Napster, which was the music peer-to-peer sharing service, although yours incorporated more multimedia platforms, so video as well. Yeah. How did you come up with that idea?
So actually that was started by a buddy of mine, a guy named Vince Bussum. And so what happened was we would hang out at the Computer Science Undergraduate Association at UCLA, and we would do a few things. We would play Double Dragon. We would do these brain teasers, these like math brain teasers, and we would find MP3s on different FTP servers, and we would download it and play them.
MP3 being these audio files.
That's correct. If you remember way back then, if you're on a Windows 95 machine, you could not, if you had a Windows shared folder and you put files in there, there was no such thing as a firewall. Mm-hmm. Anybody could get it on the internet. So we would crawl Windows shared folders across the internet everywhere. Mm-hmm. We'd index all these files, and we had a website where you'd go type something in, like Britney Spears or Green Day or whatever. And you would get the results, you'd click, and there'd be an application that would help you download these things. The problem is there are only so many sources. There's only so much supply for these files. Mm-hmm. And we got so popular that the demand was outstripping it and therefore crashing the machines that were serving these up. So people's machines would just crash without explanation because too many people were trying to connect to it sort of remotely. Sean Fanning, who is one of our users and the co-founder of Napster, was like, I can do better than this. And so what he did was he made it so that when you went and downloaded a file, that you would automatically share it. What happened in our system, you would get a file and maybe you put it in a Windows share yourself, but he made it where it automatically shared so supply and demand would go up together. And that's why Napster became Napster.
When you realized that Sean had this little innovation, what was your reaction?
Well, our reaction was, we're going to do that too. Mm-hmm. So he one-upped us, and then we one-upped him, and it was like this sort of arms race of technology.
Would Sean Fanning tell a compatible story to what you're telling?
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, Sean Fanning is an investor in Uber.
So just as Uber has faced a degree of controversy, Scour certainly had a tempestuous start. And part of that conflict came with your early investors, one of whom was Michael Ovitz, the founder of Creative Artist Agency, CAA, and the former president of Disney.
Yeah.
What happened there?
So Michael Ovitz did become an investor eventually. Prior to him becoming an investor, we sort of go through the process of getting an investment, which includes a term sheet. And in this case, it was a letter of intent that essentially said we couldn't shop a deal. Now, we were pretty thin on cash, running out of it, so we needed to get a deal done, but the deal just wasn't getting done. So the LOI ran out, we didn't get a deal done, and we had to go and find money somewhere. But once it was clear that we weren't going to get a deal done with their side, we basically got sued. And that is public knowledge. That was in the Wall Street Journal. I'm not really sure how the Wall Street Journal found out about it, but it was published there. And when when you get a Wall Street Journal story saying that you've been sued by a guy named Michael Ovitz, you are not going to get funding anywhere. So we had one option, and that was to do the deal with him, and that's what we did.
So you were sued by him because he accused you of shopping the deal, even though the letter of intent had expired.
That's correct.
And the litigation didn't end there because you were also sued by the media companies who said that you were facilitating the stealing of their content through your peer-to-peer file sharing service.
So look, these were the early days. Right now we have sites like YouTube where there's tons of content. It's hosted by YouTube. It's distributed. YouTube was sued by the entertainment industry as well. It's just YouTube had a lot more money to fight that. Mm-hmm. So we got sued over at Scour for $250 billion. At the time, we like to say the GDP of Sweden. And we clearly didn't have that in our back pockets. Mm-hmm. And so we filed Chapter 11 as what we like to say a strategic move. The media industry did not want copyright law to be settled in bankruptcy court in a couple weeks. And so we settled with them for $1 million cash, turned the technology off, and sold the assets of the company for $10 million, which is about what we got in funding.
And what was your psychology at the time? Here you are, you're 22 years old. Did you probably didn't expect to enter this level of turmoil?
Yeah, I mean, look, it was wild days. When you're 22 or 23 and you're going through this, you learn really quickly. But you also just come to accept that's how business is. And it wasn't until many years later that I realized that's not how it is.
And then after Scour, you founded Red Swoosh, which was a content delivery network, which had its own share of problems.
Well, here's the thing, right? So we created peer-to-peer technology at Scour. We got sued for it. We went bankrupt, and we had to start over again. So the idea for Red Swoosh was let's take that beautiful technology and take those 33 guys who sued us and turn them into customers with the same stuff they sued us for. When you turn it around and turn them into a customer, you say, look, peer-to-peer is really good at distributing data efficiently at low cost. So I'm going to allow a site, we never worked with YouTube, but here's an example. Imagine going to YouTube, clicking on a link, and watching a video. But instead of that video being distributed over YouTube servers and over YouTube bandwidth, which is quite expensive, it would pull from 30 PCs that had already gotten that video content. And now YouTube, in this hypothetical situation, can save hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
And why was this period so challenging for you at Red Swoosh?
It's like I was 5 years too early to market. I started in like the Dust Bowl of the internet era, right, which was 2001. There's nothing going on. And I did 4 years without a salary. That harshness of basically, I like to say, I got 100 no's a day for 2,000 days straight, which is 200,000 no's, and you keep getting up. I still got customers, but I had to arm wrestle every single one of them to the floor to get them to do it. Mm. And it was just tough.
So now you have Uber, and life seems a bit easier than it was with your former companies. What do you see Uber becoming?
I like to say that FedEx delivers packages tomorrow. Uber delivers packages in 5 minutes. It just so happens that package is a town car that will take you wherever you want to go. But once you're delivering that package of the town car, you can deliver pretty much anything. And so we like to think that we're building an urban logistics fabric, right? A real-time supply chain. And I think that gives some sort of vision for where we think this can go.
Any interesting stories about, passengers or a story with a driver or something like that?
So our community guy in San Francisco, he does all the customer support and a lot of the local marketing in San Francisco. He gets to see everything. I mean, we have a $200 puke charge, for instance. We do suspend accounts. That does happen. When we first do it, we say, look, we hear there was some activity that had occurred. We're going to have to suspend your account. And most of the time, people understand and they move on. Sometimes people go, it was a perfectly fine ride. I don't know what you're talking about. And then you respond by saying, there was some word that you had done a drug deal and were attempting to solicit a prostitute while in one of our partner's cars.
And then
they usually don't say anything else.
So here you are, you are a car service and a law enforcement service.
Yeah, we definitely don't think of ourselves that way, but they're, you know, all the things that happen in the real world, you know, this is a transportation system. These types of things can happen. And so we have to just act, you know, responsibly in those situations.
So you have a $200 charge for people vomiting in your taxi. What about women breaking their water? I was rushing to the hospital to give birth to my first daughter, and my water broke in the taxi.
So there have been a number of Uber babies, and people tweet about it quite often. So a number of times where drivers have, you know, taken a woman in labor to the hospital. We've never had a baby born in an Uber. That would be a beautiful thing in my book. We would not charge the customer for that situation, but we may compensate the driver.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
My guest has been Travis Kalanick, co-founder of Uber. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.